The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Harry Gary presiding.
Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. All right. The first matter up this morning is Jackson versus State. This is docket number 53632. Counsel, are we ready to proceed? All right. Did you want to reserve any time?
I'd like to reserve 7 minutes.
7 minutes, all right.
Good morning, Your Honors, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is David Westbrook, and I represent Adrian Jackson. I've reserved a lot of time for rebuttal in this case, more so than usual. And that's because I'm a little confused about where the state is going with their brief, to tell you the truth. And I'm anxious to hear about it because, as you'll notice in the first part of their brief, they spend time talking about upholding our past precedents and adhering to the law. And then the last half of the brief, they request that this court completely disassociate itself with analysis that concerns facts, with the gravamen test that we've used in this jurisdiction, and essentially go back to what would be a raw Blockberger test where all we're doing is comparing statutes to each other, relying on the language, and ignoring what's actually happening in court. I think that would be an incredible mistake. In my brief, I proposed to the court a test that would follow our prior precedents, including Salazar, the Eighth Circuit case of Chips, and other related cases that were included in the court's order, which was, I think, very specific and did a very good job of summarizing the state of the law out there. And in the end, I think following the approach outlined in my brief would allow us to clarify what courts should do in situations such as this one. There's no more confusion.
Well, counsel, frankly, there is a lot of confusion. It looks like our own, you say follow our case law. I can understand you arguing that. But there's two pretty important problems here. One, what is the source of this case law? And two, what is the case law? It looks like there are four different cases at least, or five, enunciating, depending on your point of view, two to five different tests. So let's begin with the source of this redundancy concept and what would be the basis for the court continuing to adhere to it.
I wrote in my brief that I felt like redundancy and multiplicity were two apples on the double jeopardy tree. It might have been more accurate for me to say that they're two carrots in the Fifth Amendment garden. I believe that what we're really looking at here is a Fifth Amendment issue, whether we want to reduce it to simple double jeopardy, which is only one small part of the fundamental fairness part of Fifth Amendment due process. The reason why we expand, and not just we in Nevada, but throughout the nation, why we've expanded analysis to go beyond double jeopardy is because too much injustice was taking place. It didn't sit right with everybody. And whether that's been labeled, as it has in Salazar, redundancy has been, I think, included on page 227 of the Salazar opinion, under double jeopardy. But whether we consider it under double jeopardy or we simply consider it under fundamental due process, for that matter, although I think it's more appropriate under the Fifth, what's really happening here is that we're looking to the facts so that we can ensure, that people don't get punished twice for the same act. That's the key. It's certainly the key in this case. And I think that even though different standards have been announced, Your Honor is completely correct, different standards have been announced in different cases, they all go towards the same fundamental goal. And I don't see where any of our cases are directly contradictory and can't coexist with one another. I just think that what needs to happen is a little bit of clarification so that we have a more clear standard that we can announce in district court when we're making our arguments.
So what would the test be if this court were to attempt to clarify the various cases that have talked about redundancy? What would the test be that you would seek?
Well, I think it would always start with basic Blockberger analysis. And it's important to note that Blockberger is not the beginning and end of double jeopardy. Blockberger is the case. Double jeopardy is the constitutional right. And that's important when we start to expand past Blockberger. That was never, I think, intended to announce the end of our legal analysis. I think it's always supposed to be the beginning. So we start with a Blockberger analysis. When you have clear statutory language and clear issues, the Blockberger will resolve them without any fuss or muss. But we're going to be required, I think, in order to protect fundamental fairness and interests of due process, to expand beyond that.
If we expand beyond that, do we have any obligation to look at legislative intent?
I think we do. It's always a consideration. In fact, I put in a two-part analysis on page 6 of my brief. Legislative intent, I think, is where it starts. Okay, but the problem that this court has run into over the years in looking at legislative intent is that's very sparse. There's not a lot out there. The legislature meets once every 2 years.
And if there's no legislative intent, or as you're saying, sparse, should the court interpose its intent or leave it for the legislature to impose?
I think that what the court has done before is taken a very common sense approach to intent. And I think there's going to be a little bit of an argument here today over burden. Whose burden is it to prove the legislature's intent? This court took the absolute right approach to that in the Jefferson case on kidnapping. And this line has been used a lot, and I like it every time I see it because I think it's one of the smartest things written in Nevada case law. It's the chameleonic attire line. Okay, I believe it's actually, that's in Salazar as well. It's in several cases. The legislature never intended to permit the state to proliferate charges as to one course of conduct by adorning it with chameleonic attire. That's the baseline rule in the state. The presumption is that we don't want to get a situation where prosecutors are charging numerous different statutory crimes for what is essentially one act, unless there's some clear intent expressed by the legislature, as in Dixon, where the Missouri court had a statute on point saying we intend multiple punishments. Unless there's some clear intent by the legislature, we don't want to get into that business. We don't want to adorn things in chameleonic attire and allow multiple punishments for the same act.
Well, relate your Fifth Amendment garden character to the facts of Jackson.
Let's absolutely
be specific. I mean, you're talking theory. Now let's be specific about Jackson.
Let's go to the facts. And what's really interesting is that the state agrees on the facts. The key factual issue in this case is that he was charged with an attempt murder. He was charged with a battery with use of a deadly weapon, and he was charged with assault with a deadly weapon. Those three charges, I mean, you would often see in a case of an attempted murder that an AWDW is a lesser included, and properly so, if the shot that was fired misses. Or a battery with a deadly weapon is a lesser included if the shot that was fired hits.
Yeah, when I was a public defender, we really liked getting a jury instruction on battery with use of a deadly weapon in a verdict form mm-hmm. to avoid an attempted murder conviction.
Exactly, because you could always argue there was a lack of intent here.
Right.
And what they did in this case specifically was they were not clear as to whether it was the battery, because two shots were allegedly fired in this case. One of them went into the victim's leg, one of them went over the victim's head. They did not specify which one of those shots was the predicate act for the attempted murder. Okay. If you assume that the first shot, the one that went into the leg, was intended to kill, then it can't stand as a conviction along with the battery of use can't stand with the conviction along with attempted murder because, again, you're talking about a situation with lesser included. If you assume it's the second shot, the shot that missed, that was charged as an AWDW and was the predicate act for the attempt to kill, then they can't stand together. My argument in the brief was because the state did not specify, and they absolutely could have. I mean, they have, as they will tell you, all the rights in the world to charge even redundant cases or even redundant statutes within a case, they could have specified and they didn't. And so when we're talking about fundamental fairness, what we're talking about here is somebody who was charged with an overarching continuous course of conduct charge like attempted murder. He wanted to kill this person. And then two essentially lesser related charges where he was convicted of everything. Those can't stand. I'm talking about Fifth Amendment fundamental fairness. I'm talking about double jeopardy. That's what I believe our Constitution was trying to avoid. Okay, so that's hopefully take us out of the garden into the courtroom where we belong. But if you adopt the state's position, which essentially, and again, I'm going to be anxious to hear how they express it in court this morning, seems to me to be, let's just look at statutory language and nothing else. Let's ignore the facts in the courtroom and proceed that way. If you adopt that language, what's going to stop the state from, every time there's a battery case where multiple punches were thrown, charging a separate count of battery for each punch? Every time there's a kidnapping case where a pharmacist is taken around a drugstore to different counters, a separate charge of kidnapping for every single movement within the store. If you adopt that approach, I don't think there's any end to the number of charges that will be piled on. Certainly the state has a reason to pile on as many charges as possible, because it really helps improve their position in negotiations, and it has a real effect on the jury when they see 20 charges in a case that should have two. So with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttals unless there's more questions. No? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Nancy Becker from the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and with me today is Kristen Kramer. Ms. Kramer will address the issues that Justice Cherry raised with regard to the specific facts and circumstances of this case, and I'll spend about 10 minutes talking about the general issue of multiplicity and redundancy. First, I think it's very clear, and there's been no cases cited in the brief to the contrary, and all of the federal law indicates that redundancy or multiplicity, which I think we can all agree looking at the research at this point in time, our term redundancy is really what people refer to in the federal and in other states as multiplicity when you're talking about post-conviction. It's not a constitutional doctrine. It is entirely a matter of legislative intent. And as such, if the legislature wishes to punish a transaction under more than one statute, it can do so if that's its intent. And so I think that what the state tried to do was to talk about our cases and how they fell within the existing framework under other state and federal practices. So there's no constitutional pinning for this rule. It is solely a matter of statutory construction. The only time it rises to a constitutional level is if it meets the definition for same offense under Blockberger, and then it becomes a double jeopardy issue. And even then, as Missouri v. Hunter pointed out, where the legislature specifically says, yeah, we intended both these statutes to apply, even though they have the same elements, then the legislative intent controls and there's no constitutional violation. The due process comes into play when you're talking about charging and notice at the beginning of the case in a pretrial issue. It doesn't come into play, and there's no cases out there finding that this is a violation of due process in a post-conviction scenario.
What are we to do with lack of legislative intent?
Well, I think that what the court has done in the past and what you see from the states, there is no clear majority rule, at least that I could ascertain. You have federal courts in some states who have said that absent a very specific indication in the statute, the more specific statute will control, where two statutes both cover the same criminal activity, like mayhem and battery with substantial bodily harm and Salazar. The presumption is the legislature intended both to apply, and it's something for the legislature to address, and they can easily do that. As I noted in my brief, many states have actually said that in their state statutes. If two statutes apply to the same criminal conduct, that the one with the higher penalty is the one that is applied. You can be convicted of both, but you can't be sentenced.
Our legislature has done that in lewd
construction, that the more specific statute applies versus the general statute, mayhem being the specific statute for disfigurement. But the real issue is what method of statutory interpretation should be used when you're talking about a multiple statute scenario, not a single statute, where you're trying to figure out, is it a course of conduct or are we punishing individual activity? When you have a two-statute scenario and the statute has different elements, so they're not double jeopardy issue, there's no double jeopardy issue under Blockberger, then all of the federal courts and the majority of the state courts say At that point, there's a presumption that both statutes were intended to be enforced and were intended.
So at that point, we would have to overrule Albitre to accommodate our law to the test you're articulating.
No, I think that Albitre and Salazar, the problem is there is not a lot of analysis. So,
but what analysis first, could save Albitre from the dustbin?
Well, I think that you don't have to overrule it. It's true that the state is indicating to you that you have two choices. You can indicate that to overcome that presumption, you need clear legislative intent, either on the face of the statute or in the legislative history. And beyond that, we're not going to go. That would require eliminating the concept of the gravamen test and Albitre, and that's quite correct. If the court is not inclined to do that, that would certainly be the black letter or the easier test to apply, the clearer test, the test that would give district judges and litigants more clarification, and allow the legislature to decide. Do we want to enact a more generalized statute like other states have done, and not have the court in the business of trying to figure out through rules of statutory construction or gravamen whether or not the legislature intended both punishments to apply. The other way is that you maintain this concept of the gravamen test, and what you're looking for is from the face of the statute or the legislative history, can you determine what is it that the legislature was intending to punish? As in the situation where you have assault with a deadly weapon, you have battery, and you have attempted murder. Battery is the injury. It's the actual injury. That's what the harm is. That's what the punishment is for. Assault is the fear. It's a crime of fear. And it is the fear that you're being punished for. You can commit a battery and a person never have been afraid because they don't know it's coming until they get hit. But that fear is a distinct injury that the legislature intended to punish. It's the horror involved in knowing that something's going to happen to you or could happen to you that you face. Attempt to kill is the intent to kill. It is the intent itself, whether or not successful, that is the gravamen. We don't want you going around intending to kill people and doing something to facilitate that. That would be the gravamen analysis.
Ms. Becker.
Yes.
Washoe County's amicus brief suggests that we focus on, or we overturn Albitre, and yet recognize a societal interest in Talon-Kahn. Would you comment on that?
You know, I have to be frank in that I'm not certain I understood, so I don't think I can comment because I wasn't certain how that would work. My own view is I think that you go with the more bright line rule, as suggested in Washoe County, that you look specifically at the statutes. And you can look at legislative history, and it's true that sometimes we won't be able to locate it, but sometimes the legislature does say, well, what about this? Could they be punished under both? Well, no, they could be tried under both, but not punished under both. It would be an alternative pleading. But absent that very clear indication, the court wouldn't get into the gravamen kinds of things. So I think that's something that you'll have to leave to the next argument for an answer, because I honestly can't give you one, Justice Hardesty.
All right.
I think then that the other thing that the court should do is distinguish between single statutory analysis where multiplicity also comes into play. Those are the cases like Bell or Chips where you're talking about Is it a course of conduct that's being punished or individual acts? Is it each sexual penetration or is it the entire scenario of the assault? In this instance, of course, Nevada has long said it's each penetration, and that's what the legislature intended. I think that you need to distinguish because in those scenarios, it's the reverse. If you can't clearly find that the legislature intended it to punish the individual acts, not the course of conduct, the rule of lenity doesn't apply. And I think there's some confusion in that, particularly when we talk about CHIPS. And one last thing, in terms of the burden of proof, I think that it always begins with the defense. They're the ones raising the motion. They have to demonstrate that somehow multiplicity or redundancy comes into play. Once they do that, then it becomes a matter of law that the court must undertake. There's no factual analysis. And all of the cases in the briefs deal with very narrow cases where in order to determine what was the number of units of prosecution, you had to look at the facts. And under that scenario, once they make a prima facie case, the defense, then the state has to present evidence. Most of the time, you're talking about statutory construction. There is no evidence. There is no burden of proof under the circumstances. So unless the court has additional questions, I'd like to give Ms. Bramer the ability to address Justice Cherry's arguments.
Colleagues, any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Kramer, I'm going to ask you to take us back to the instructions from the judge where either the information or the indictment was read to the jury as to what the particular facts were for the particular offense. If you could be specific, I think that'll answer my question.
Okay. I know as to count one, the attempt murder of the deadly weapon, it was the specific facts as we alleged in the complaint were that, or by the information, I'm sorry, were that the said defendant firing at the body of said James Duffy. The assault was by the said defendant pointing the firearm at the head of James Duffy and firing at him. And then the battery was by the defendant shooting the said James Duffy in the leg with the firearm. And then as we argued it in Deputy District Attorney Cheever's closing as well as in my rebuttal, we made very clear to the jury that when we're talking about the attempt murder, we're talking about the struggle between James Duffy and the defendant in the bathroom, when the defendant for the second time says to James, okay, now where do you want it, head or chest? Because I got to get out of here. I've already shot you in the leg once. Now where do you want it, head or chest? We made it very clear that that's what we were talking about when we were talking about the attempt murder.
Well, I have to admit those are unique facts.
They are unique facts. They absolutely are unique facts, which is why the detectives originally were just like, this is such a fantastic story that they almost didn't believe James until they saw the video corroborating what James said. But he says to him, where do you want to be shot, head, chest, or leg? The victim chooses the least thing that he can think of that might cause the less injury to him, and the defendant chooses to shoot him in the leg. If that was the attempt murder, then the defendant, if that's what we were saying was a specific intent to kill, he would have disregarded what the victim said, shoot me in the leg, and would have gone for the head or chest, knowing that that probably would have killed him with the intent to kill. But that's the battery with the deadly weapon. It's absolutely a separate action within this 1.5 hour, maybe, course of conduct, but he kept that victim in that bar. And then there's some time that passes before he says to him, okay, I gotta go. Now where do you want it, head or chest? And the victim decides, he's already shot me once. I know I'm about to die. Then he pulls for that gun. The struggle ensues. He shoots him. He misses him during the struggle, and then during the struggle, he tries firing the gun two more times. That's from the trial transcript, page 96, when James is testifying. He tries to shoot him two more times, even after he's tried to shoot him, that shot missing, going into the bathroom wall. So we do have some very unique facts in this case. It's not just one continuous course of conduct. If maybe we just had that one shot where it went into his leg, maybe then we could talk about that there it could be two and it was redundant, but that's not what we have here. We have him choose and shoot him in the leg, causing the battery.
I'm anxious to see how Mr. Westbrook's going to overcome these facts.
And, Judge, you know, one thing when I was, I do want to point out to the court, it's outside of the facts of this case, but when we were reviewing everything and looking at the judgment of conviction that was done in this case, I would ask the court, as part of its order, to remand it to the district court for clarification of the judgment of conviction. The judgment of conviction, excuse me, does not go along with what Judge Adair ordered at sentencing. At sentencing, she ordered count 2 to run consecutive to count 1 and count 3 to run consecutive to count 2. That's at page 8 of the sentencing transcript. The judgment of conviction is actually, as was prepared by the court and filed by the court, it's actually silent as to concurrent or consecutive on the count 2, and then it lists count 3 as concurrent to count 2. So when I was reading appellant's brief, he mentioned that it was a 10 to life. It actually would be more than that, Your Honors. It would be a 21.7 to life. So I would ask the court to ask the district court to change their judgment of conviction to reflect that. If there's no other questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Just on that last point, I would ask the court not to do that as something presented during oral argument based on supplemental briefing that was never brought up in the original appellant's brief. I don't think can be
was
brought up.
Was it correct or incorrect?
I have no idea. But if they want to bring a motion to correct something, they can certainly do that. However, under case law, the signing of the judgment of conviction is deemed to be a separate act of intent by the judge. So even if the judge did say consecutive sentencing at sentencing, that's overruled by the judgment of conviction. And today, here in this courtroom at oral argument, it's not the time to make that argument. I think that's inappropriate. And there's no jurisdiction to hear it here today.
What about the facts, Mr. Westbrook, the particular facts? You know, sometimes bad facts make bad law when you're a defense attorney.
That's true. Here's the issue with that. First of all, I want to read from their brief. This is the state's brief. However, the attempt murder assertion could involve either or both shots, parentheses, or a completely different shot, end parentheses, than the one set forth in the assault and battery counts. Because the same exact physical act, i.e. shooting at the head and missing, or shooting in the leg, might be the same physical act supporting the attempt murder allegation, a redundancy analysis is appropriate. Now that sounds like it would be from my brief, but it's not. It's from the state's brief. And the point is, we cannot ignore how the jury was actually instructed on the law by the court and the information that was actually filed. Now, if we were in a situation, and this is where it goes to the facts, where they did not charge attempted murder at all, if they simply charged a battery for the shot in the leg and an assault with a deadly weapon for the shot over the head, given the odd and very specific facts in this case, those two might be able to coexist. But the fact is, they charge attempted murder. This is a much more serious charge, and obviously they wanted a much more serious conviction. But they did not make the choice between the two shots. Since they did not make the choice, in the information, the jury was instructed as to the law exactly how it says here in the state's brief. So therefore, even though the facts could be distinguished, legally they weren't distinguished. The state even admits that if this court is not inclined, and Your Honor, you're completely right, this would be the end of Salazar, it would be the end of Albitre, and a host of other cases if you adopt the state's position. That's the only way that I can see it working, which is why I saved so much time for my rebuttal. That's what I thought they were saying in their brief, and that's what they said. It would be the end of those cases.
Counsel, the argument was, we argued this in closing argument. What is your position as to that?
As I've been told by district attorneys many times, and as juries are always told, arguments by counsel have no bearing on the case, and they are not evidence. Consider them for what they're worth, but they are not evidence in the case. You were instructed on the law by the court, and the court instructed in this case that either or both shots could be the predicate act for the attempted murder.
You said our closing argument has no bearing on the case, or it's just not fact.
Okay. Closing it, you're right. And I always hope that my closing arguments have bearing on the case, to tell you the truth. But they're not law, and they're not evidence. And that's what everyone's always told. They're not law, and they're not evidence. The law is given to you by the court. And, you know, whenever a defense attorney like myself starts talking about the law and getting far afield, I'm always shot right back down, and appropriately so, by the district court, because I'm not a judge. In this case, the judge said either one of those acts, either one of those shots, can form the basis for the attempted murder case. So therefore, they have to merge. That's the way our law goes. Again, I'm troubled by the concept that we would essentially remove a lot of the state's good work in attempting to look at facts and see that justice is done. And if we adopt this so-called bright-line rule, I don't think it will be workable at all. I think it will require legislators in a certain sense to have a crystal ball and become Nostradamus and try to think of every eventuality. There was something that was said. regarding the how we figure out legislative intent. By the way, in this case, I believe Skilling, the latest United States Supreme Court case, provides. This is an excellent example of how that case should be used. A situation where we don't have a clear analysis of intent. It's not, and it's fact-based and case-based. I believe this court has always proceeded along the following rule. If the legislature is not clear that they want two punishments for the same act, then we assume they only wanted one punishment. And that was the case in Jefferson, and it was said again in Salazar, I believe. It's certainly the spirit of Albitre. And as the court pointed out, as I believe Your Honor pointed out, we actually do have statutes where they've said we anticipate multiple punishments for this one offense. They've done it before. They don't do it here. They certainly don't do it with assault with a deadly weapon, battery with use, or with attempted murder. Given that, at the very least, what should happen in this case is that the assault with a deadly weapon and the battery with use should be vacated. And I would encourage the court to adopt the formula that I outlined in my brief or something similar to it, because I believe it preserves our case law without discarding what makes it just. And that's what I think the Fifth Amendment Court requires.
All right, colleagues, any questions? Thank you for the briefs on this. They're quite informative. Appreciate your arguments today, and the case will stand submitted.